You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Brian Callen Show. Sadly, Brian Callen could not be here for his own podcast because he's such a busy, famous working actor and general entrepreneur that he actually is out of town right now. But it's his loss because with us on the line, we have Dr. John Rady, who has written, by my count, 9 books.
Right.
Am I missed? That's a reasonable estimate.
Right. There are 2 other books, but they're in both in Mandarin, written for children. but you know, I don't want to. I didn't write them. They're really new books. So anyway,
what is it, you didn't write a book in Mandarin for children?
No. Both Taiwan and mainland China decided they wanted to put Spark into cartoons for kids, so they did it on their own, and it's in Mandarin, and I finally had it translated, and it's, I don't understand it, but anyway.
But listen, I mean, this is how impressive our next guest is. He's managed to find something that Taiwan and China agree on, which is how great your books are. So, I mean, you know, you really, Donald Trump has tried to claim that he's the unifier, but I think that John Rady is a better candidate for the unifier. So, yeah, I mean, Dr. Rady, I mean, you know, I think the simplest description of what you are is a medical doctor and a neuroscientist, and then on top of that, an author. And it seems like much of your work focuses on bringing the latest neuroscience into the hands of the general public.
That's exactly what I've been doing and trying to do, actually, since we began with Driven to Distraction back in 1993. But it's a good way to put it, trying to make neuroscience and the disorders and ADD, autism, many others, into something understandable from, like you said, the neuroscience into lay terms in a way. And so that people can really grasp what's going on. And I think with Spark, we really did that. So it got people to be aware of what exercising does for them.
Well, and that's the amazing thing, because the first of your book that I actually ever read was A User's Guide to the Brain, Perception, yep. Attention, and the 4 Theaters of the Brain. And, yep. You know, that was, I mean, I think a great, great intro to being able to sort of understand a lot of neuroanatomy, how that develops into thinking, how that develops into processing, and then have been a fan of your work ever since. And yeah, I mean, it's been interesting to see just the progression as well in your writing as you figured out the right balance between the amount of science that you communicate to the public and what's going to be most emotionally impactful. And yeah, I think with Spark, you really nailed it.
So I think so, because it's so relevant to all of our lives, how we move and why we move and what it does.
So why don't we start there with Spark, the revolutionary new science of exercise in the brain, and, you know, just give our listeners a little bit of an overview of what the book does.
Well, what I did was try to present the brain or what exercise does in our brains in terms of changing our brains, how it does that, how it makes for emotional regulation, improves the attention system, improves our memory, and also helps manage our moods so we don't get as depressed or we get undepressed, helps deal with stress, helps deal with the addictions. And most importantly, in some ways, it helps us preserve our brain so that we don't go into the cognitive decline and Alzheimer's disease that we're seeing run rampant in this country and all over the world. That exercise is the one thing that we know will keep our brains young and perky. Also, I should also point out that so will optimal weight, both of those together.
But there, there's, and you know, this sort of goes into, you know, your next book, but the, there is, I mean, you know, the West has a real bias towards thinking about everything in terms of parts and thinking that everything is one thing. And so when people talk about, I mean, I had a conversation yesterday with someone about obesity and exercise, right? And they were like, obesity is, you know, mostly a function of diet or is a function of diet. But the point is that, you know, you really have to look at both, right? You're not going to get away with, you know, eating healthily and not exercising, and you're not going to get away with exercising and not eating healthily.
Right. I do think I mean, the diet is so important when you're talking about obesity. And what my book is not about how to get slim.
Right.
It's not about looking for looking both short term and long term, but mainly for managing your brain. So, and today the focus really has to be in terms of motivation about how we're going to feel better today and why, and then long term how we're going to be better, how our brains are going to be better and why.
Yeah, and if I had to pick out a hero of Spark, it would be BDNF. So why don't you tell us, is that a fair assessment?
Yes, 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 yes. But that's the hero of neuroscience for the past 15 years, 20 years or so, because everybody wants to know about BDNF and measuring it and trying to figure out how to crank it up. And the biotech industry has been trying to figure out, okay, how do we make more BDNF? And today, looking for a new antidepressant out there. The drug companies are looking. The thing that they want is not raising your level of serotonin, dopamine, and norepinephrine, but how do we raise the BDNF levels? Because it's so important. It's such a great antidepressant. BDNF is brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which basically means it's brain fertilizer. It means it helps our brain cells grow. We have 100 billion of them in our brains and many more throughout our body. But every time we use our brain cells, we make more of this stuff. And this stuff does everything that fertilizer should do, especially mm-hmm. keeping our brain cells healthy, keeping them ready to work the way they're supposed to work, and in all, keeping everything going and going well.
And so this and the exercise is the thing that we know most strongly triggers the production of this BDNF, this brain derived neurotrophic factor.
Right, and that's because one has to know that our brain evolved over 100-300 million years as hunter gatherers. Our big brain evolved to help us be the best movers, to help us be the predicting, sequencing, planning, imagining, movement evaluation, consequence evaluation, expanding our working memory. These are all parts of the brain that got added on as we evolved. We co-opted. We used those same moving new brain cells, 100 billion, the ones we added on, to this 100 billion group of nerve cells, we use those new ones to think with. So our thinking brain is really our moving brain. So when we move, we activate our thinking brain. And that's really where the magic lies in terms of preventing Alzheimer's disease, but also raising test scores in kids. And in anybody who, any age group that you do it, you do a pre and post with a 10-minute exercise bout, the scores are going to be higher. Anywhere from 10 to 20% higher. They're going to be acutely and then chronically over time, you see the brain, we see people getting smarter. Their IQs raise, their test scores raise, their quick thinking from one thing to another rise, you know, and so it's really an important integral part of all that.
And so just to be crystal clear, If America wants to improve its test scores, it doesn't just mean more classroom time. It means exercise.
Absolutely. It means play and exercise. Play first. Mm-hmm. Play for the little kids. You know, I mean, that's so important. To get the little kids are coming into school now not knowing how to play.
Right.
They just don't. They just, because they don't play anymore. You know, they're not outside anymore. They're playing on their video games, or they're playing on their cell phones, or, you know, they're addicted to, you know, the internet. And that's happening all over the world. So you're seeing kids not being used to play, not knowing how to play, and they come to school and they need to learn that. Unfortunately, we are seeing many, many school districts getting rid of certainly physical education in the lower grades, but also recess. You know, they're taking recess time away because the thinking is the more seat time kids have, the better test scores they're going to have. And it's really quite the opposite. And there's many studies showing that this is the case. But the prejudice, the bias, the way we were taught is the more you drill, baby drill, the better your test scores are going to be.
And I think that's the point, is that part of what we're seeing is this is the sort of the ultimate extension of that sort of Western way of thinking that tends to focus on it's this one thing and there's a math equation. And the more we apply that math equation of seat time equals learning, then the better it will get.
Correct, correct. I think that's not now. It's, you know, the East Asia has adopted that view too. So you can't. They're beginning to change, but it changed back to the way they used to be. But mm-hmm. But they're driven by, you know, beating out everybody else for that job. It actually started with them with Confucianism. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we don't want to get into that. But it's. It is really misapplied thinking,
mm-hmm.
and yet we persist in this because the biggest currency in the schools is not money. It's not money for new facilities or new teachers or extra PE teachers, for instance. If you're going to talk about increasing activity and exercise, it's the biggest currency is time.
Mm-hmm.
No one wants to give up time because they're being judged and on how well their kids do in this class or that class, and that their belief is it's all about them getting enough time with those students to drill it home.
Well, and it also, I mean, because, yeah, my background is in education, what you also see is that it also shifts the kind of time that they think is worthwhile. You know, the time becomes narrowly focused on trying to impart the material and the curriculum, rather than, for example, looking at what do these children believe about their own learning? Do they actually believe that they can learn? Those sort of conversations that, you know, from that sort of strict rationalist approach seem nebulous and, you know, perhaps a waste of time. And wouldn't we just be better off sitting in, you know, putting another hour of classroom time where they listen to whatever content it is that we think they need to know?
Right, right. No, I mean, we do operate on the Newtonian way of thinking and not a chaos theory way of thinking where everything counts.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's important. And we think like you, the math equation, you know, A plus B equals C. Mm-hmm. That's not the way it is.
Right, right. So I think that's the thing is that there are school districts. I mean, you talk about it in Spark that have really applied, you know, this whole new of thinking and have instituted 0 hours where these kids go and they run and they get exercise. And as you said, like it has these amazing effects on test scores.
Right, right. That's a specific class for readers going into ninth grade that were not the greatest readers. They needed mm-hmm. more help. So they had a reading readiness course and then a math readiness course. And what they found was that if they did their PE and did it vigorously right before the class, that their rate of improvement doubled or tripled compared to the other kids who didn't come in early or didn't have their PE class right before, which is really something that we see and have seen again and again. They did it in a very nice way, but more importantly, more impressively for that school in Naperville 203, District 203, is that 19,000 kids, 3% of them were overweight. There wasn't one kid in the two high schools of 7,500 students that was obese when they looked at them in 2003. And 2 years before that, the school, 99% of the school took the TIMSS test, the International Science and Math Test, mm-hmm. which every country takes every 3 years. And the U.S., we took it last year. We came in 19th and 20th in science and math. They came in as they were lobbied to take it as a country, and you could do that. So a test district could take it as a country. They came in number one in the world in science and number six in math.
Wow.
So not only were they among the fittest students in the nation, they were among the smartest in the world. So it just riveted me into finally getting this book together. Because here was, we had a lot of, by the time I sat down to do this book, I knew we had a lot of examples, a lot of studies on preventing Alzheimer's disease, keeping our brains young. A lot of studies. The Mayo Clinic's 2 years ago reviewed over 1,600 studies that have been done, mainly since the mid-90s, on exercise and cognition, especially in the elderly, and especially as a prevention against cognitive decline and Alzheimer's disease. But we didn't have such great studies with kids. You know, there wasn't that overwhelming, oh my God, we got to be doing this. Mm-hmm. Except when you look at a school like Naperville, which is in a class by itself. And when other schools get it, when they get into getting their kids fit, which is, by the way, back to the 60s with John F. Kennedy. I mean, that's what he was pushing, you know, to have kids fit both in body and mind. And he pushed it as a presidential, you know, direction, getting everybody fit. And there's a couple of documentaries coming out showing, you know, what this was about. But, you know, we need to relearn that and get back to that.
Well, and also, I mean, the benefits obviously are not just academic. They're also in terms of healthcare costs and all of those sorts of things long term. And I just wanted to, so my girlfriend works in neuroimaging, and I went and saw her boss, Arthur Toga, speak at USC. And he gave, and I think this is the statistic he gave, but that from 2010 to 2050, the cost of caring for people with Alzheimer's in today's dollars will exceed $20 trillion.
Yep. And if we can make a dent in preventing that, mm-hmm. preventing the onset of cognitive decline and Alzheimer's disease, which we know that exercise and optimal weight will do, you know, and because they're linked, but they're also covarying. So they vary with each other, but they also have independent effects on preserving our brain structures and keeping our brains working for us rather than losing our minds, which, you know, I mean, so he threw a scare in terms of cost, but and I always start off usually lecturing always with a few slides and a few comments about Alzheimer's disease, because everybody can relate to it, because mm-hmm. everybody knows somebody, or the, you know, aunts, parents, somebody who's been afflicted, and they are worried about it for themselves, so they pay attention to that, whereas no one is afraid of diabetes, heart disease, cancer, yes, but not so much, you know, because But uh, and and but they are afraid of losing their minds, of being mobile without having an having a history, having agency. And they see it, they know it, they hear about it, they've seen the movies, whatever. It really is something that people are still afraid of, so that hopefully this will be the clarion call so that they can begin to do something that will help prevent this tremendous onslaught that's coming.
And that's, I mean, that's so much of what the challenge for Spark or for any of these books is that what they're talking about is prevention, which is not something that we like to focus on in the West because it doesn't feel tangible enough to us, like drugs and, you know, surgeries and things like that. It just requires a way of non-Newtonian thinking that is not something that we have been trained in or that we have developed or that we were particularly trust. It's weird that, you know, that we would make this a priority, whether it's actually, you know, scheduling class time in schools for it, or, you know, whatever way it is that we make, you know, exercise a part of our communities and our culture.
Exactly. We've forgotten, you know. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that we decided, okay, we're not going to exercise anymore, or we're going to make life so comfortable we won't have to move. But we have. And that's the way we've evolved. We've amused ourselves and applianced ourselves to death, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what's happened. You know, we have too many things that make everything too easy.
Yeah.
So and we don't know that. We don't remember that because we don't remember what it was like before the microwave and the TV and then the TV clicker. You know, it's like you're in the middle of life and you don't think, okay, this is a big change, when it's a huge change from where we were.
And we certainly don't remember or particularly identify with the people who still live the way that we did 10,000 years ago.
Correct. And we've learned so much from them as well, you know, that, or people that are successful in aging. For instance, the Blue Zones, you've heard about them. Mm-hmm. They it's where people live to, you know, usually a big number live to over 100. In Okinawa and areas of Japan, and actually in Italy, some areas, and in the Ukraine, not what we're familiar with, but certain towns, certain areas where people are living to a very old age, and not only living longer, not only not having physical issues, but they're involved. They're still working. They're still doing stuff. They're still part of life. They're connected to their community, their neighbors. And they, you know, and a big part of it is that they're moving all the time. They have to, because they're scratching out, still close to scratching out an existence by what they do.
Well, and also, I mean, I think the other thing that I've always found fascinating is that, you know, in terms of that generation, whether, you know, the Greatest Generation or any of those, you know, some of the baby boomers that are now moving into retirement, is that there you have a tremendous group of people who are desperate to be involved, desperate to help, want to be useful to their communities. And for example, in terms of tutoring and working with kids, could be such a tremendous resource that we really just don't use.
Oh yeah, no, it's something that I think is hopefully going to come around. I mean, almost 20 years ago, when got to know a little bit about some of the aging communities or communities for the aging, you know, that were connected with universities or colleges, and they were doing that. It was like you came to some of these colleges and you got a grandparent. you know,
which is great.
And which is benefits everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the child coming in who's a little bit hesitant of what's going on, and they all of a sudden they have a grandparent, and they can visit with them, and they can learn from them, and strike up a great relationship. And so, I think that's the kind of thing we're hopefully going to expand on as we, you know, as we move on in this journey.
Yeah, it reminds me of. Did you read "Being Mortal" by Atul Gawande?
Yeah, I did. Yes, great book.
Yeah, and there's great stuff in there just about a lot of different retirement communities. And, you know, I mean, there's the sort of the institutionalized clinical ones, which feel a little bit like Romanian orphanages.
And then
there are the ones where they let them have things like pets and, you know, projects. And, you know, I remember there was one where, you know, they had college students and retirees cohabitating. And just sort of the benefits that both got from that experience.
Right. No, it's really, I think we're learning so much about that. And about there, I think the big thing that we're relearning, it's not something that we haven't known, but about maintaining connections,
mm-hmm.
As we age, as well as maintaining usefulness. Being useful is really, really part of our genetic core. And useful to others, not just to ourselves, and that can keep the brain going.
I remember. So there was at some point there was some big brouhaha in the UK about, you know, they had all these Amazon workers, and you know they were working in this warehouse, and you know their salaries weren't very good, or whatever it was. And they asked some old man about how he felt about all of this. And he's like, I love this company. You know, I was unemployed for many years and they gave me back my dignity.
Yeah, no, it's the usefulness of living is being useful is so important. And, you know, I hear stories all the time about retired dentist, for instance, who was getting depressed on antidepressant, anti-anxiety pills, and his psychiatrist, a friend of mine, said, living in Florida, playing golf, and you know, doing everything that he was supposed to be doing, but he was bored. He was felt useless. So my friend said, "Well, why don't you start bagging groceries?" Six months later, the guy comes back, and you know, he no longer needs his medicine.
Funny.
And you know what? He's bagging groceries, but he's just like your Amazon guy.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I have a purpose. And he was the best bagger, and everybody loved him. The other employees, the people coming into the Winn-Dixie for their, you know, shopping, they wanted to be in his line because he was so positive and helpful, and he loved doing that, and he was getting positive feedback all the time, and he loved it. You know, he didn't need the money, but he loved it. Loved what he was doing, which is, you know, Shista Mihaela talks about flow, the flow experience. That's where we want to be, and that's where getting back to exercise. That's what I talk about in Spark, is getting into that flow-like state and staying there.
And I mean, that's the thing. I mean, one of the words that you've used so much in this interview is relearn. And I mean, I think that really taps into your most recent book, Go Wild.
Yes, it does. It does.
So,
yes.
So tell us about Go Wild.
Well, Go Wild is basically an extension of Spark. And it's looking, I mean, the Spark, the big thing I learned, and hopefully people will learn, is that we evolved a great brain to help us move, you know, move better. And we use those same nerve cells to think with. Well, we also evolved these genes that have us doing things that make us most human, like eating right, like sleeping enough, like being present, like being out in nature. And of all things, being connected and remaining connected to one another and to ideas and to like your Amazon guy and my Winn-Dixie guy, you know, they were connected to the community that they were working together with. And they not only had their dignity, but they had a purpose and they enjoyed it. And we need that. I'm working with a group in Silicon Valley now whose sole end point is to get the elderly not only to move, which is where I come in somewhat, but also to get connected and stay connected through the movement, through their actions, and then to connect with others so that they're not lonely. They're not just sitting in front of their computer or getting drunk or stoned or whatever. They are still active, and active for themselves and for others, which is the highest form of activity. So they're small. In Go Wild, I talk about how we evolved in small tribes. It's great to have Facebook and you have 60 billion friends, you know, but you need to have that personal interaction and also people that you enjoy seeing and being in the same space with. So I think that's we're relearning that. What we call rewilding. We're rewilding ourselves. We're learning, and I think it's really starting to happen. Just this past couple of years, even in spite of our horrible political situation right now, but we're learning that we need to be personally responsible. More of us are. Okay, and not only to avoid Alzheimer's, but to avoid all the huge cost in healthcare and the huge problems. And no one wants to go in a hospital ever, and they shouldn't ever, if they can help it. So it's all about prevention. So it's about paying attention to what our diets are, and to getting rid of sugar, to getting rid of starch, to saying, look, this has been our food pyramid has been upside down, and we've been fat phobic for too long, and we're now, eggs are back in, and they're going to remain in. It's okay, certainly some of the meats and mainly the fish are in. Vegetables are really always have been in, but they're really in now, and you're seeing less and less people using the quick processed foods, the everybody's organic, natural, blah. I'm not sure they're as legitimate as they sound. But
yeah,
one has to be careful. But I think what I'm saying, the reason why they're successful is that people are paying attention to that.
Well, and I think, to your point that, this is really a movement that is going on. I mean, the paleo movement really is looking back to trying to figure out how we used to live. Now, how good they are at that or, whether or not they're achieving that, it is the same sort of impulse. And Jared Diamond's most recent book is The World Until Yesterday, which very much struck a chord with a lot of the themes in Go Wild. So there is this real idea that, for a long time we've operated under the arrogance that the Enlightenment figured out everything, it knew everything, modernity was great, and we should just be more modern. But there is this recognition that actually ancient peoples have a lot to teach us about how to live.
Oh, exactly. And that's where the blue zones come in, where seeing these people live successfully and with good lives on into their 80s, 90s, 100s, that not only are they living longer, but they're living better longer. I mean, that's really the mantra, just not to, you don't win an award for making it to 100 unless it's better. It's more fun. It's more, you get more out of it. And I think that's what in Go Wild we sort of hit on what I think are the major themes, that we need to be more present. We need to be more mindful of what we're doing. Not just in meditation is just part of that. It sort of teaches us mindfulness. We practice mindfulness, but there's also being mindful of where we are and what we're doing and looking around us and When you're in nature, you're much more mindful of what you're doing, as well as we need nature. You know, there's so much data that we have, so much science that we have showing us that we need to be in nature, that we get better the way we in nature. Our inflammation changes, drops. Our blood pressure drops. Our pulse drops. The Japanese have a thing called forest bathing for health. They go out for their vacation to the forest and bathe themselves in the forest, out in the middle of nowhere, to get away from the hustle and bustle of life, but also to get reinvigorated, to, you know, get themselves back and prepared for the rest of their lives.
And I think that's part of what I'm really picking up from what you're saying is that we can't, you know, whether the government figures itself out, that's, you know, a large and complex problem. The individuals really are, and presumably as individuals start to find more common ground as the public does, then we'll start to have a shared base of operations from which we're working on so that we can then, you know, our leaders will respond to the fact that they're massively out of touch with reality.
Yes, 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 absolutely. And what's important in our lives, you know, what's important for, I mean, that's the big thing with education. I think what's important in education, are we just, do we really need everybody to go to college? You know, and that's gonna be a question that's coming up. I mean, do we need that? Oh, it used to be the case, but now you have all these 25-year-olds sitting around with one or two degrees and no jobs for them. So, you know, we have to really pay attention to that and restructure our thinking and reevaluate what we're doing. You know, the millennials I think it's a great generation that they know they're not going to have a job for 10 years or 20 years or their lifetime. And they know they're not going to have a pension. They know they might not have health insurance. So in some ways, this, hopefully, if they're aware, and a lot of them are, they have to be multi-talented. They have to be interested in a lot of different things. They have to be ready to move, ready to change, and also paying attention to their own health and welfare, which I think is great, you know. And so I'm all for that. You know, there's a lot of them just living in the basement playing video games. But, you know, there's a whole group that are just doing outstanding creative stuff.
Well, and I think the other thing, too, is that, you know, human biology is on our side. It's the same thing as your Winn-Dixie guy or my Amazon guy. Martin Seligman really talks about the difference between pleasures and gratifications. And so it seems like it's more fun to be playing golf all day in South Florida or to be playing video games in your parents' basement. But actually what it does is it makes you depressed. And then once you discover the pleasures of being useful to people and being engaged, you realize that's a far more pleasant experience. So it's not a question of it being an argument. It's just that you have an idea of human biology that doesn't actually fit the reality of human biology. And once you have that other experience, you'll come to realize that it's actually much more fun to be useful and contribute and all of those things.
Yeah, no, there's no question about it. And I, you know, having a purpose and meaning and all that, just a friend of mine said the other night, Mark Twain said there are two important days in our lives. One, when we're born, and two, when we find meaning and purpose in our lives, mm-hmm. which I think is really what's important. And then you get on a mission, and then you can't, you know, if you get on the correct mission, you can't be stopped. You know, it's because it's fulfilling. You don't need to have a big check. Yeah, you know, it's nice if you do, because then you don't have to worry about it. But it's better for you to be doing what comes naturally. It's not just having fun. But it is having fun. It is being in flow. It is being grateful for all that you have and all that we have in this country. You know, that we have this opportunity to be the best we can be.
And that's the interesting thing, is that, you know, we all know that on a personal level, but we never, you know, only some of us extend that to the societal level, because there's a real, you know, this myth that capitalism was all about the fact that greed is good, has so permeated the culture that it's, and there's a low trust in other human beings. You know, we believe that, yes, I, left to my own devices, would still work because I crave meaning, purpose, and being useful. But those other guys, you know, they would just be bums and loaf and, you know, cheat us all.
Right, 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 right. Well, we have to deal with that. But I think I really, truly have seen, and I was, 2 years ago, I wouldn't have said this, but I really think that we're beginning to see closer and closer to that tipping point where this is going to be the order of the day, that personal responsibility has to come back, because our institutions have basically failed us, and they're going to continue to fail us, and they're there to support, but we have to continually reconstruct them.
Mm-hmm.
and not be so dependent upon them, and teach resiliency, you know. And that's a big, big part of what exercise and play does. It teaches you to be resilient in play, which is going out of our lives and out of our kids' lives in the physical play. We're talking interactive, rough and tumble play, which we used to do all the time, from four square to tag to all kinds of, you know, interactive games out on the in the recess yard or in the building. Doesn't have to be outside. You know, these are gone. Kids are staying inside, glued to their screens. And so they're not experiencing that joy of movement, or that joy of wonder. And, you know, 'cause they get all their answers from the media, you know, and it's driving us crazy. You know, Jesus. You know, we don't think, there's not the authenticity or the agency that we used to have to have.
Donald Trump is authentic.
Pardon?
Donald Trump is authentic.
Yes, he's really one in a million.
You know, he tells it like it is. You know, that's what the American people like about it. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't mince his words. You know, he doesn't apologize. But no, but I mean, actual genuine authenticity, I mean, I think that's something that a lot of people hunger for. And increasingly, like you say, it's not that everybody's find it, but more and more and more people are finding their way to this way of thinking.
Sure. And they've been doing it. I mean, the younger generations have been doing it for some time now, is giving up on giving up on the opportunity to earn a big bucks. Because they want the job that means something. And I've seen this over the years. They want a job that means something to them, not just a paycheck and or a way up the ladder. Sure, they'd like to go up the ladder, but if they don't, they have what they care about and what's meaningful to them. And we're seeing that, I think, more and more and more. And that leads to creativity, because it's a necessity to sort of stay nimble on your feet when you're in this generation that are in their 30s and late 20s now, where they know, like, hey, things are going to change, and not for the best, so I better be multi-ready to go into this field or that field, which I think is great. Which is being present and being mindful of where they're at and where the world is.
Well, and also being aware of the myths you have internalized from your culture about what people can and cannot do.
Yeah.
So you can overcome those.
Yeah.
Well, fortunately, you know, while we've all been bickering about how human beings actually work. There's been a lot of great science going on to better understand and, you know, clarify and build on a lot of ancient insight so that we now understand human beings with a level of precision that would not have been possible 50 years ago. And fortunately, we have people like Dr. John Rady who are there writing great books to make all that science accessible to those of us who have jobs and are busy and have kids and have other things to think about. And I would say you will enjoy any of his books, but Spark and Go Wild are great places to start.
So thank you for the pitch, because I do think that they both have addressed a need, but certainly Spark has really sparked a lot of action around the world, and getting people to move again, and getting programs to change, and people saying, "Oh my God, I didn't realize that when we move, it's for our brains as well as our bodies. In fact, it might be more important for our brains, not just to preserve it, but to make them work optimally, to help us feel better, to help us, you know, be at the highest level of well-being that we can be."
Well, so. I don't want to stereotype our listeners, but I would say that they are generally in amazing shape. And, you know, really just perfect physical specimens. And so they will be keen to have a book that they can share with, you know, mere mortals to let them know that, yes, A, they can have this experience too, and B, it is important for all parts of them, not just their bodies, but also for their minds.
Right, right.
The old adage, mens sana in corpore sano, a healthy mind and a healthy body, turns out to be true.
Yes, absolutely. So,
Dr. Rady, thank you so much for writing 9 amazing books and for coming on the show to talk to us.
Great, and thank you so much for having me.
And
liked our conversation a lot.
So did I. And keep up the good work. Keep spreading the gospel, and I'm happy to count myself among your disciples.
Okay, very good.
Talk to you soon. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been the Brian Callen Show without Brian Callen yet again. You know, we can't give you pure Brian Callen all the time or you'll get spoiled. We have to build up your appetite so that when the kid does return to his own podcast, that it's appropriately messianic. In the meantime, here's John the Baptist preparing the way, the voice in the desert. That was Dr. John Rady. And you should check out his books because they are really both excellent. Thanks so much.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.